Good morning.
This meeting is
Welcome
being
to
recorded.
Radio Economica this Thursday morning. We are happy to have with us Jorge Vallejo, who has come to talk about a brief that he published recently entitled The Collective Intelligence We Need. Good morning, Mr. Vallejo.
Good morning. I hope you are all well and you can hear me well as well.
Yes, well, let's keep fingers crossed.
Very good.
Yes.
So
you published this piece, and we're not very far away from the European Summit. Yes.
Yes. So basically, since we are slowly nearing the end of the year, and also it was the first year of von der Leyen Commission, and even the end of the decade, because the real end of the decade is this year, it was not last year. What I wanted to do is to look back a bit and focus on one angle, one point that I mentioned in this article, where I spoke about the importance of collective intelligence as it happens in other periods of history, like during the Greek times or the Italian Renaissance or the American Revolution, or even the founding fathers of the EU in the 40s, 50s. But what I wanted to talk about is specifically about how the self-absorption of Europe that we witnessed over the past years on the Greek crisis, on migration, on Brexit, and how this has diverted energy and time and priority given to issues like the digital transformation and our geopolitical weight, while the world was changing and at a huge speed around us, and the whole rule of law discussion and dispute with Poland and Hungary for the past weeks in order to approve the MFF, the long EU's long-term budget and the recovery fund, has been the latest example of what I mean. And actually, this is something that it's a kind of a complaint and lament that you can hear in some diplomats, that we spent a lot of time and energy with our internal quarrels, trying to agree on common positions, while we are losing perspective and we are losing ground on the big transformations around us. And I will explain more in detail, and we'll give you examples of what I mean, specifically focusing on the economic front, of course, on migration, and also on the technology and the rise of China, which is the most important and biggest transformation that we've seen over the past decades, if not even centuries. But we have to say that actually this, let's say, our focus on or our all the attention and time and energy that we've given to our internal problems started even before the Euro crisis and the Greek crisis in 2012 and 2015, when basically the Eurozone and the EU as a whole were at the edge of the cliff. I mean, you might remember all the problems and institutional discussion we had with the approval of the Constitution and the Lisbon Treaty in 2005 and then 2009. And all of that, and you might remember as well that that famous quote from the former Belgian foreign minister Eskens, who said once, described Europe as an economic giant, a political dwarf, and a military worm. And this is basically the problem we've seen over the past years, that we are one of the largest economic regions, I mean, together with the US and of course not with the rest of China, but we cannot leverage that power. Why is that? Because we continue to have an incomplete economic and monetary union. We continue to to fail to address properly our strategic challenges like migration, like our energy dependency. And what was particular of the past decade until the COVID crisis, we must say, is that we failed to progress in crisis times, but truly progress, because I will talk about this more in detail. What happened, for example, during the Eurozone crisis, we came up with the ESM, which was, of course, something that we needed, and it was an important progress, having a Eurozone bailout fund, and we came up with the banking union. But it's been 8 years since that moment, and for example, the ESM, of course, it was already completed, but it was not fully functional or fully, targeted for what we might need to help countries with, for example, more agile preventive instruments. And that reform just happened this December, and it's still needed to be ratified with the Eurogroup approval of this revision of the ESM treaty. And the banking union, which was launched in 2012, the most important or ambitious leg of that banking union, which is the European Deposit Insurance Scheme to protect the poor savers across Europe, it's far from a political agreement, but even at a technical discussion, there hasn't been any progress over the last months, of course, partly because of the pandemic. So it's no longer necessarily true that we truly progress in crisis times. The same we could say about migration. I mean, what we saw in the migration crisis in 2015-2016 is that the leaders came up with Frankenstein solutions that after were so difficult to implement that there was nothing no revision or no institutional review of our solutions to address the migration challenge. Besides what was agreed in terms of hotspots and all these kind of patchwork solutions. And I remember when I arrived in Brussels in 2008 that migration was already being discussed with that directive of return. And still we haven't come up after 12 years with a coherent solution to that. The latest attempt was this autumn with the proposal from von der Leyen's commission, but it's still unclear how they're gonna address or how they're gonna narrow the differences between those countries at the forefront, those countries in, of course, on the southern countries, France, Spain, Italy, Malta, Cyprus, and those northern countries. So we dedicated a lot of time over the past years to try to address the Greek crisis, of course, to bolster the economic and monetary union, to come up with a coherent migration policy, and to address the UK's departure from the EU. But what we have seen on each of these points is that at the end of the day, on the economic and monetary union, there was no progress on the real issues. For example, a Eurozone budget, a central fiscal capacity, the European deposit guarantee schemes. On migration, no progress at all. On Brexit, we saw how the UK and the EU were practically negotiating until the very end the three same issues, fisheries, the governance, and the labor playing field. Why? What happened over there?
Do you think this is...
Yes, sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry, no. On Brexit, do you think the EU has been weak in that case?
Of course, I mean, and this is something that I was going to say now. It's The EU is not the one to blame, or I mean, because in any negotiation there are it takes two to tango, as they like to say. And the EU, as they like to say, commissioners, Barnier's team, they were very clear from the beginning of about their priorities and what they were asking for. Basically, since the UK wanted zero tariffs, zero quotas in order to access the internal market, that required a level playing field. So the UK will have to fulfill the European regulation in order to have that, let's say, free and open access to the internal market. But there's been, I don't know if there's been a lot of inflexibility from the European side, or maybe the UK lack of political willingness to approach the EU. But at the end of the day, what we have seen, and that's a fact, is that both sides have been discussing the same issues for 8 months. And now, looking back to what I was saying on economy, on migration, this all happened with no real progress on any of these issues, while the world was changing hugely around us for two reasons. One, two reasons which are interlinked. One is the digital transformation, which has changed how we live and how we produce at a space, scale, a deepness, and deepness as we haven't seen in decades or centuries, with this fourth industrial revolution, which includes robotics, big data, artificial intelligence, supercomputers, so on and so forth. And basically, this fourth industrial revolution is the one who has pushed China to become, I mean, a superpower at par with the US. Soon will become the most powerful economy and a tech superpower, and it aims to surpass the US, for example, in terms of artificial intelligence, will be the engine for the future transformation. And of course, it's not still the most powerful nation in terms of defense, but it's growing, and it's growing fast as well. And what happened with the EU in terms of technology? Well, I mean, there is no European company among the 15 leading technological companies. We are so proud of our investment in research and development, for example, with the Horizon program, but this is only a fraction of what China invests in artificial intelligence, only in one priority. And while China, for example, I'm gonna give you a figure. China, in year 2000, EU spent 1.67 of our GDP in research and development, which was almost double than China. And now in 2018, I think the figure is from 2018, we are at par with China, around 2.2% of GDP. And China is even, I mean, already surpassing us. So we are missing this transformation that is happening around us. And of course, that is having an impact on our geopolitical weight. I mean, the key word now that became so trendy in Europe, having a geopolitical commission, our sovereignty, so on and so forth. And the European leaders realized of that. For example, the famous Macron speech in La Sorbonne in 2017, the key word at that speech, in that speech, was strengthening the European sovereignty. And it was a year later when Juncker in his final State of the Union, he also prioritized this external dimension of the EU, and that's when he came up with the idea, for example, strengthening the global role, the international role of the euro, which was a way of, let's say, let's gonna leverage our economic power. And of course, I mean, the euro the euro is it's a very important currency together with the dollar. For example, in terms of transactions, we are not very far from each other. The problem is that the euro is not a reserve currency as the dollar is. So this is an important distinction. And what I was saying until now, it's all until the pandemic hit, because what we've seen in the response to the pandemic and its consequences is that there's been a leap forward, especially in the economic response when it comes to, for example, to the creation of the recovery fund, the Next Generation EU, especially on that, and also the monetary response that we've seen from the ECB. I mean, it was a big stimulus, and all this has happened in a change of economic paradigm that we can talk about that another day, more towards a more Keynesian let's say stance. But what happened with the recovery fund is that finally we created that, let's say, central fiscal capacity that the common currency needed in order to address and to absorb sudden shocks, which was the intended goal with that Eurozone budget that at the end was totally watered down. And it was basically a priority that it was constantly requested and suggested by the International Monetary Fund and by the ECB. So what is going to happen now? We don't know. I mean, for example, the IMF and the ECB recommend that this Next Generation EU becomes a permanent instrument. Also, we need to see what is going to happen in terms of the future MFF, how we're going to implement our innovation priorities. But we need to rethink, and this is something that it's already in the air when you talk to diplomats. And as I said at the beginning, it's something that it's in the air. After these vetoes, Hungary and Poland vetoes to the recovery fund, is that we need to rethink our decision-making process. And this is a complaint that has been there for years. For example, when we discuss tax matters and when we discuss foreign affairs issues, we need to rethink this unanimity problem or challenge. And secondly, even some diplomats suggest that these countries need to rethink their stance on European affairs. I mean, whether they want to be members of the club or not, because over the past years, it's always, I mean, the usual suspects are always or mostly Hungary and Poland on climate, on migration, on values, or even when there are foreign affairs discussions on Russia, they are always the ones mostly going against the consensus, and in some cases creating a lot of problem. For example, with climate, is mostly Poland. With all the values issues, is Hungary and Poland, and now we've seen that the two of them are blocking this big stimulus that is needed to overcome the most severe recession in the EU history in 7 decades. So this is a bit of an introduction, maybe a bit too long, and I will be happy to discuss now maybe this first opening comment.
Of course, you covered a lot of ground because you refer to the tension is around the adoption of the recovery plan. I mean, the political agreement is there, but the entire process for 27 states, and you mentioned the problem of unanimity, but there could be solutions for that. And on the other hand, you mentioned that we have come out with innovative solutions. After all, perhaps a bit late, but this 1.8 trillion euros is a rough calculation since the beginning of 2020, or since March, April. It's something like 25% of GDP, which has been committed among the European Stability Mechanism, the ECB, the European Central Bank, the MFF, and the Next Generation EU. So what you are seem to be attacking is rather the governance issue in a way, no?
Well, basically what I did is I make a difference. I distinguish two moments or two periods. Basically, one is the whole past decade until before the pandemic, and how we basically we were so focused. I mean, we of course focused on our problems, our challenges, especially the economic part, the economic leg, and migration, and then Brexit came. But by doing that, not necessarily we came with the necessary solutions, and that's what I'm saying, that we not only focus on our internal problems, but we lose perspective of what was happening around us, and at the same time we didn't find the necessary solutions. And then second part was the pandemic, which was actually the biggest crisis we faced as a bloc in since the beginning of the Union 7 decades ago. And then we've seen a major leap forward, and that's true. I mean, in with the recovery fund, and that's we created this central capacity budget to address this the crisis as a bloc. And not only that, by issuing an unprecedented amount of debt, what we're going to do de facto is to create these, the so-called, the famous Eurobonds, because we're going to issue so much EU debt for to finance the recovery fund and to finance also the SURE mechanism to support workers. Around, it's going to be in total around 900 billions, which so in de facto this is going to represent the introduction of the Eurobond in the markets, because what we saw until now is that of course there were, let's say, European bonds issued by the European Stability Mechanism or by the EIB, into the European Investment Bank, but the amount was very small compared to the volume and that is going to be issued in a very short period of time or in a short period of time. So that's going to have a huge impact in the markets. And not only that, there's been a huge appetite in the markets for these EU bonds. So if we put together this recovery fund, the central capacity, and the facto euro bonds, yes, this represents a big step forward in this second part, let's say, of the crisis period that I was talking about. The problem is that there are still two issues that remain to be addressed. One is the decision-making process that I was talking about, with the unanimity challenge or discussion, debate. And the other one is what to do with Hungary and Poland. And this is, of course, it's not something that needs to be, let's say, discussed and addressed only from, let's say, the other 25 countries, but also, I mean, together with Poland and Hungary. And it's a debate that must take, first of all, and primarily must be addressed from within Poland and Hungary. I mean, if they're going to continue blocking every, let's say, major discussion, either on climate or existential issues like the problems like the pandemic, like as it is the case with the recovery fund, then they will need to rethink or reconsider whether they want to be members of this club. And this is something that you could hear in some diplomats that, I mean, that they are tired of having always, you know, these two countries dragging their feet. So with this, let's say, long overview of what we've seen over the past decade, I wanted to highlight how this, let's say, a self-absorption made us lose perspective of what was happening around us, especially with the digital transformation and the rise of China. And at the same time, how till the July summit, actually, how we basically failed to make really progress, find a breakthrough on the key issues, either the monetary union or migration, and of course, I mean, the energy dependency, another strategic challenge that we have. It's something that we could address thanks to the Green Deal, because we're going to invest a lot in renewable energy, and also we're going to address, for example, energy consumption with several initiatives that we're going to take. So that was a bit of, let's say, my approach. And of course, I truly acknowledge the progress we made in July, but still we need to find how we're going to address these unanimity issue.
A final remark, final questions, because our time is nearing its end. You gave us an article by SEPS where you say that this article says, you mentioned unanimity, but there are ways to go forward all the same, maybe. And you say, instead of waiting for all member states to adopt a common threat perception, that's regarding foreign affairs, we should monitor perhaps in a limited number. I'm referring to the end of this article, which does make proposals. We do not have to remain stuck, or do we?
No, of course. I mean, and there are some issues. For example, the Commission already suggested on humanitarian affairs, some, let's say, chapters of foreign affairs where we could and we should make progress. I remember, I'm gonna recall this. I mean, I might be wrong, but I think it was a couple of years ago when there was a vote on human rights, and I think it was related to China, and the EU couldn't adopt its position because Greece blocked that the common position on a human rights affair. So if the EU, which I mean in its opening article has, I mean, the protection and of the human rights and fundamental values as, I mean, like preceding its fundamental charter, and we cannot protect and defend that abroad, at least even in a declaration, I mean, that gives a very poor image of the Europe and even Europe soft power, which is at the end of the day the only thing we have until the day that, of course, we succeed in strengthening our, let's say, defense and geopolitical weight. But if not even in a statement and in words, we can, let's say, protect and defend that, I think we're going to continue to give a very poor image of the bloc beyond our borders.
Okay. Thank you very much, Valero. You're chiding, and I mean, that's a chiding for the collective. European Summit, see if we manage to take a few steps forward. Also, whether the budgetary negotiation come to.
Sorry, I lost what you said at the beginning.
I just said that we have to wait till I mentioned the fact that you were Delivering a chiding, in a way, and you know, the delay and failures in quick and collective decision making. And I just mentioned the fact that we have to wait till the next European summit to see if we have a clear stance on foreign affairs. We have a number of issues there, and also whether the budgetary negotiations can at least be finalized. I think wait and see. I have to thank you.
Well, yes.
Sadly.
Yes.
Sadly.
Yes. Yes. Very good.